892, please.
Yes. 892, amend the property maintenance code to implement recommendations of the Quality Rental Housing Work Group and to incorporate additional requirements per state statutes along with corrections for clarification.
Colleagues, today I'm requesting the council adopt an ordinance that will amend the property maintenance code to address mold, lead-based paint, and other health and safety issues impacting Portland's housing stock. This ordinance is the culmination of a project that began all the way back in 2008 when the Quality Rental Housing Work Group recommended code and program changes to help ensure Portland's housing stock, especially rental units, were safe and healthy. BDS, the Bureau of Development Services, staff worked with the Housing Bureau, the City Risk Office, the Multnomah County Health Department, local licensed industrial hygienists, and contractors certified in dealing with mold and lead-based paint to develop a model approach that incorporates best practices with the goal of ensuring the new requirements are reasonable and provide a path for improving housing conditions, which often have a direct impact on the health of our most vulnerable residents. BDS staff also worked with the Rental Services Commission and Housing Oregon's Property Management Asset Working Group that included Northwest Housing Alternatives, Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, Community Partners for Affordable Housing, Human Solutions, Reach Community Development, and Innovative Housing. I'm very pleased to present these changes to our property maintenance code, which includes first of its kind regulations for addressing mold in rental units, as well as new and enhanced requirements to control lead-based paint and pests. The ordinance also ensures requirements for carbon monoxide detectors are met and makes minor amendments for clarity. I'd also like to thank all of the stakeholders who provided their input and their expertise to BDS staff on this project. With that, Beth Benton with the Bureau of Development Services is going to introduce our presentation on this ordinance, and she and Nancy Thorington are available to answer any questions after the presentation. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Beth Benton. I am the Property Compliance Division Manager for BDS.
Could you please pull the mic just a little bit closer?
I can actually speak up if I need to.
Good. Thank you.
How's that?
Perfect. Thank you.
I'm also here with Nancy Thornton, our Code and Policy Development Analyst for BDS. The original purpose for the amendments to Title 29 was to move forward the 2008 Quality Rental Housing Work Group recommendations related to property compliance work. Because these recommendations were made 10 years ago, I would like to provide a brief history and background for context and then summarize some of the substantive amendments and, of course, allow time for questions and discussion. Everything began on September 22, 2008. That was when the Quality Rental Housing Work Group presented recommendations, including amendments to Title 29 to Council. 7 days later, the national housing market collapsed, followed by an economic recession. Over the next 4 years, from 2008 to 2013, development and construction activities plummeted and BDS began layoffs. And in 2009, we were down to only 4 code enforcement inspectors for the whole city. One positive note was in 2010, code staff was able to enact the Enhanced Rental Inspections Program as a targeted pilot, which was one of the recommendations from the Quality Rental Housing Work Group. Then, from 2013 to 2018, the Portland economy and housing market began improving, and BDS began hiring multiple positions to meet the demand. And in 2017, Rebecca Esau became the new director of BDS and began a total reorganization. Early in 2018, staff met with Commissioner Udaly and began reviewing the prior recommendations of the Quality Rental Housing Work Group, as well as researching various technical aspects in order to begin drafting amendments to Title 29. By the fall of 2018, a series of meetings were underway with industry professionals, subject matter experts, and staff from the Multnomah County Health Department to discuss drafting amendments related to mold, lead-based paint, and pest management from a technical and a best practices point of view. In May and June of this year, we shared our proposed Title 29 amendments with a variety of housing stakeholders, all of whom are identified here on this slide. These stakeholders were extremely helpful. They provided feedback, perspective regarding potential impacts and effectiveness, as well as offering recommendations for consideration regarding forthcoming administrative rules. In keeping with the purpose of Title 29, our amendments are designed to provide a minimum requirement with regard to potential lead-based paint hazards, mold, carbon monoxide detection, as well as pest management and sanitation, all as recommended by the Quality Rental Housing Work Group. We intend for these proposed amendments to have a positive impact, ensuring that housing units are safe and healthy and improving the quality of life for all Portland residents. And finally, to ensure there is clarity for code language. The most significant Title 29 amendments, which are based on the recommendations of the Quality Rental Housing Work Group, are pest management and sanitation, hazardous materials, specifically lead-based paint, interior dampness and mold, and the required inspection section, which will enable our enhanced rental inspections program. Each of these presents an opportunity to effect a positive change for everyone, especially landlords and tenants, and most importantly, for those members of our community who often face real barriers to access affordable, safe, and healthy housing. So to summarize the pest management and sanitation, there are amendments to several sections of Title 29 regarding pest and sanitation, which will work together in tandem to provide further clarification for pest management and for reducing the accumulation of garbage as a harborage for pests, and to provide language for additional administrative rules. The goal is to reduce and prevent health-related impacts from traditional pest treatment methods and other health-related conditions resulting from inadequate sanitation. This will also help reduce the use of and possible occupant exposure to toxic chemicals, especially in multifamily buildings. Furthermore, having a pest and sanitation-specific administrative rule, we can ensure the application and use of integrated pest management processes for rental properties. Number two, hazardous materials. This amendment will further define lead hazards and, most importantly, provide language to establish administrative rules for additional requirements related to potential lead-based paint hazards. There is a need to increase lead awareness and provide health protections for tenants and property owners of pre-1978 housing. We are planning for the forthcoming administrative rules to provide an opportunity for continued education for landlords and tenants regarding the potential hazards of lead-based paint, and to provide for additional requirements to ensure everyone working on pre-1978 residential dwellings where painted surfaces will be disturbed are trained and certified as a renovator in keeping with the State of Oregon's adopted requirements under the EPA Renovation, Repair, and Painting Rule, also known as RRP, to ensure safe work practices are followed and to reduce possible exposure to lead paint hazards. The Quality Rental Housing Work Group recommended that we define and eliminate excessive moisture that creates conducive conditions for mold growth and to require remediation. It is well proven that mold is a symptom of an underlying moisture problem, and the key to mold control is moisture control. For many, there can be direct health effects from increased exposure to mold spores. Attempting to regulate mold activity is not an easy proposition. Because there are no scientifically measured standards and no determined safe levels, and this challenge has been playing out across our nation for the past 18 years. To quote the New Jersey Department of Consumer Affairs from 2015, the department will not promulgate regulations for mold remediation because there has been no universally accepted technical contamination on clearance levels, unquote. This is significant because 4 years later, in 2019, still there are no national nor scientific standards regarding mold spore levels related to specific health impacts. In fact, the State of Oregon Health Authority, through their Public Health Division of Environmental Health, does not regulate nor test for mold. Not only will the City of Portland be one of only a few municipalities in the nation that cites mold as a violation condition in our local property maintenance code, we are also going to try something slightly different. Because we know that mold is a symptom of a moisture problem, we will not be attempting to measure quantities of mold spores for which there are no standards. We do intend, through this title amendment and administrative rules, to focus on moisture control as both a required correction and a preventative measure, and to also establish treatment criteria based on the presence of mold and specifying who can perform the work. I would also like to add that we were fortunate that staff from Legal Aid shared a copy of the presentation of our proposed amendments that we gave to the Rental Services Commission with Dr. George Tsongas, a retired professor emeritus of mechanical engineering with Portland State University and a nationally recognized building scientist with 40 years of experience specializing in moisture and mold issues in housing. As a result, Dr. Tsongas contacted our team and has offered his technical guidance on these amendments. He has also generously offered to work with us moving forward and to provide additional training for our inspectors. Number four, required inspection section. The amendment of the required inspection section will enable the creation of an administrative rule to provide the framework for the ERIP, or the Enhanced Rental Inspection Program, and also allow us to make additional ERIP-triggered inspections. ERIP functions this way. An inspection is performed based on a tenant complaint or referral from police or other agencies. If the identified violations found during the inspection exceeds more than two violations in either two of five categories, such as fire life safety, no utilities, electrical issues, for example, then we request to inspect additional rental units. This program has been expanded citywide, and operating with additional requested inspections is voluntary. This program is valuable. It only applies to rental units, and typically, most ERIP cases involve older multifamily units, which represent a large number of the affordable housing units here in Portland, whereby maintenance and upkeep throughout a building and the individual units is critical. Finally, we recognize the value in involving a wide variety of community members and housing stakeholders in drafting regulations. Therefore, we plan to engage a variety of tenant, landlord, and community groups as we draft administrative rules. And as promised, we plan to return to present our drafts to the Rental Services Commission, Housing Oregon, and the Housing Development Center's Working Group for their input, their support, but most importantly, to ensure that all viewpoints and all concerns are considered from an equity perspective. And I'll be glad to entertain any questions.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. I appreciate your presentation. You talked about mandated inspections, and then you talked about complaint-driven inspections. So what's the difference in the two, and what triggers one versus the other?
Excellent question. Currently, what triggers all of our inspections, they are all complaint generated. So everything starts from a complaint or referred complaint. The mandatory inspections, what we're referring to there is the secondary post-inspection that becomes an ERIP case, the enhanced rental. So if we receive a complaint at a rental unit and we do that inspection, if there are enough violations present based on our five categories, then that triggers additional inspections of that landlord's rental unit. So it may be all of the remaining units in that building. It may be a percentage of units in the complex. It depends on the size of that particular property.
And can a tenant file a complaint anonymously?
Anyone can file a complaint. We keep the complainant information anonymous.
To the extent the law allows that.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's anonymous to the extent the law allows that.
Correct.
That I'm sure will be challenged both by the media and in court. And I'm not actually entirely confident we can keep that information confidential.
Well, I mean, I asked the question because clearly I live in a community that has some poorly maintained affordable housing units. And if you're a tenant and you're living in a poorly maintained apartment complex, it's not to your advantage to turn in your landlord to tell someone how horribly bad your unit is, especially when you can't afford to move. So I do think that that's a critical issue, that through the administrative rules process, we have to create a safe place that people can say this is the problem without them being negatively impacted by that. So I don't know if that means a whistleblower protection. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it looks like because I did not go to law school.
You mean like a no retaliation provision?
Yes, exactly. I mean, yeah. like, there has to be something in there that makes it okay for a tenant to be able to turn in a building without them ending up on the street.
Definitely. Here. Commissioner Udaly, then Commissioner Fish.
Thank you for the presentation. First, is the Bureau still on track to implement rental inspections for all units, so getting away from the complaint-driven system to mandatory inspections?
That has not fully been determined at this point. Today, we're just bringing these amendments for these particular subjects.
Okay. And I have a scenario, a real-life scenario for you that I'd like to share. A friend of mine rents from a landlord in North Portland who owns multiple older properties. He is aware that there is mold in his buildings, and he has his tenants sign a document when they move in acknowledging that they know that there is mold there and taking responsibility to regulate it and also taking responsibility for any damage that's caused by the mold.
Legal?
Is this legal? I don't think it is. And will these amendments help us enforce on landlords like that?
I believe they will. I can't speak to whether or not that's legal or not. Ultimately, based on Title 29, it's the property owner's responsibility to maintain their property at these minimum level thresholds. So if we get a complaint for mold and we identify mold, ultimately it's going to be the property owner's responsibility to correct that problem.
Commissioner, you are right. My lease agreement actually says that if mold shows up, somehow it's my responsibility because I failed as a tenant to make sure that moisture was cleared up in my apartment. So I asked about it, and the answer was it's just standard language in the contract. So I do think that there's a difference between what we want to do and what the current reality is that we need to take into account.
So there is mold that can be caused by tenant behavior, like if you're running a humidifier, if you've got boxes stacked up against a wall, you know, there are. But in this instance, this is a landlord that knows that he has a mold problem in the building that is not related to tenant behavior. It's related to the condition of his building, and he is trying to move that responsibility off of himself and onto the tenants. As far as retaliation, you know, one of the great side effects of RELO is that landlords are less likely to retaliate, and one of the things that we heard from BDS, which was in my portfolio at the time that we passed RELO, is that they did see an increase in requests for inspections because tenants felt like they had some insurance against retaliation. Landlords can make your life miserable in other ways, though, so that is why I think that we just need mandatory inspections and we need to get away from a complaint-driven process because the people who complain are people who feel entitled to complain and know how to navigate our system and feel some kind of security in their housing. And that is certainly does not describe many of our renters, especially if they are low income or people of color.
I totally agree, and we recognize that as an issue.
Mayor Fish.
So I was housing commissioner back in 2008, and that slide brought back a flood of memories. Quality Rental Housing Work Group came out with their recommendations. There were a lot of good ideas, but no way to pay for them. Then we hit the worst recession in our lifetime. And in fact, for the next 3 years, about the only construction that occurred in the city was affordable housing, thanks to stimulus dollars and thanks to other tools that we had. The concern that I have on any of these programs is that we have the staffing and the resources to actually do the job. Because when we announce that we're going to start doing something like inspections and we're putting this into our code, we have to have the resources to make sure that we can deliver. So in connection with this code change, how many people will be assigned to this task and what is the budget ask?
Good news is there is no budget increase or ask. We are fully staffed currently. We have approximately, I'm not sure how many housing inspectors, about 19, I believe, that are will be handling all of these inspections. We also have senior housing inspections, inspectors in place also.
So 19 people whose job it is just to do rental inspections or who are housing inspectors who housing will also be doing this work?
Correct. They do.
Which of the two?
They do housing inspections and rental inspections. They're all considered minimum property maintenance inspections.
Is that enough?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, for now. Now, and we'll want to track that. And you say no budget ask because it's already funded within the Bureau of Development Services base budget?
Correct.
Okay, so let me take you to another hypothetical. An inspector gets into the apartment and is looking for things like mold and asbestos and other things that we regulate, but also determines that there are some life safety issues. How do we make sure that we're coordinating with the Fire Bureau and our other professionals so that we're not fixing one problem but overlooking another? And I'll give you some examples. Overloaded circuits, newspapers stacked by a fireplace, all kinds of things, clutter and other things. All of these are things that produce risks for homeowners and property and tenants, but technically don't fall within your purview. They are things that in the past we've talked about having Fire Bureau people do door-to-door. Well, maybe they do fall within your purview. You're nodding, so they do?
Yes, they do, sir.
So if someone walks into an apartment to do an inspection based on a complaint around mold, and they see life safety issues, they can flag those as well?
Absolutely. We do a complete full property maintenance inspection. We look for smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors, damaged flooring, peeling paint, plumbing leaks. We're looking for every violation we can find. It's just whatever the complaint is what gives us the opportunity to enter for that inspection.
So it gets you in the door, but correct. Whatever you find there, you document.
Correct.
And then you put the landlord and the tenant on notice once
correct.
You've done that.
Correct.
So, I mean, things like a non-functioning fire detector alarm, that's something that has to be remedied immediately.
Correct.
Other kinds of things are more subtle. So good to know. So you have 19 people who will be responding to complaints, and you do a full-service inspection, so whatever you find while you're there, and they're documented. And have you made some projections as to how many complaints you anticipate handling in the first year?
No, not exactly. This kind of falls under the purview of the base of the complaints that we're receiving now.
Oh, thanks.
It's just the way we're going to handle these violations. We're going to have some extra tools in our toolbox.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commissioner. And I want to close the loop. So you find these fire violations, then are you in communication with the fire marshal? How do we close the loop? What happens after you write all that stuff down?
We issue a formal notice of violation to the property owner. They're giving a certain amount of time to bring those repairs into correction and call for a reinspection. If they don't, they are fined.
So how does fire know that there's a more severe fire danger, say, here rather than somewhere else?
Like a sprinkler system deficiency or wholesale violations of smoke
detectors? That would be more of a commercial setting. We would alert them at that time.
Say that again.
We would alert fire at the time of the inspection. A lot of the sprinkler inspections are done through our Chapter 13 program inspections, which is older multifamily buildings.
We have I live in a rental apartment building, mm-hmm. and we've got sprinklers. So I think what the commissioner is asking is, what is the trigger that has the threshold you have to meet in terms of an inspection that automatically requires a referral to the marshal, so the marshal can do his or her own follow-up if necessary? Fire marshal.
It would be the level of the violation that the inspector is viewing during that inspection, which is going to vary inspection to inspection. The trigger for the fire marshal is going to be for multifamily buildings because it's commercial and that's where they have authority. The fire marshal, I don't believe, has authority in single-family dwellings.
Right.
Well, right, but we already know multifamily apartment dwellings that don't have, say, a fire escape or don't have sprinkler systems mm-hmm. in place, right? We actually already know that. So if you're going into one of those places due to a complaint-driven process, the question is whether or not the fire marshal is also engaged in that dialogue. And mm-hmm. doesn't sound like they are at this point.
Normally they're not, because we're looking to make sure that each unit meets the building code requirements for smoke detectors in that unit. And so we're checking to make sure that the ones that are there are operational, and then also if they are missing, that they are flagged to be replaced.
So this sounds like, as part of the administrative rule writing process, that we may want to engage the fire marshal and figure out a proactive way that we can actually get more impact for the limited resources that we have. Because it seems like, unless the fire marshal is notified, then they have no impetus to actually prioritize that property as they're trying to decide where they're going to do inspections, right? I mean, if your folks are already doing it and you're meeting the fire marshal standard, they need to know that because then they can take it off of their priority list. And so I just want to make sure we're not duplicating efforts and all of us ending up in the same building on different days for the same kind of inspection.
Absolutely. It makes perfect sense. We are already in communication with the fire marshal, so we will make sure we add this information to those conversations.
Well, and have a more formal process so that we all know
Absolutely.
Who does what, when, and why. Thank you.
Very good. Any further questions?
I just love these geeky conversations.
Public testimony on this item, Carla.
Yes, we have four people signed up.
Very good.
The first three are Diana, Maggie, and Lightning.
Very good. Thank you for
your
presentation.
Thank you very much for your feedback. That's been very helpful.
To be continued.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
Very fascinating stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Good morning. Morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Diana, and I heard a lot of good stuff in regards to Title 29 and amending that to make it more suitable for the citizens and people who reside here in Portland. There are a lot of good questions asked, and some of the questions that I have is in regards to the training. Who is going to be participating in this training? Will landlords that are registered and known to be landlord owners, will they be mandated to participate in this training so they can be educated on the updates that are coming down and the requirements that they must fulfill? Other questions that I have is, what happens to the families and the tenants that are identified in a unsuitable, unhealthy living situation? Where are they going to go? Is this going to cause further displacement, or will we be setting up provisions to take care of these families and tenants that need shelter? The last thing we want to do is push someone on the streets. However, safety is of the utmost importance, and I don't feel that lack of shelter in this sense is an excuse. So I think that needs to be at the forefront of everyone's minds, because it does take a lot of courage to complain, especially because being a tenant and you're complaining about the property that you're living at, there are ramifications, there are ways that landlords can just bite at the tenant in a passive-aggressive way. So the other thing that I was wondering is whether or not BDS would be open to establishing a complaint web portal in a way that would allow people to file complaints through a system that would be assigned a tracking number, so that if it ever goes forward, there could be that level of confidentiality maintained because it's not giving tenant information, it's giving a tracking number information instead, saying these are the things that have been brought up to our attention and we want to inspect these things. And with that, it also will produce data. So when it gets brought up again, there is something substantial that can be pulled and drawn on. Even if it's creating a hotline number, and then with each hotline number, there's a spreadsheet that is generated, and in that spreadsheet specifically for complaints, you have a tracking number. So I think that this is a good thing, but there are a lot of things to be figured out in the process.
Thank you. I actually think that's an excellent idea, and I will ask staff at the end, because I think we may be on track with that, right? So, but your point is extremely well taken. Great idea. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Okay. Hi, Maggie Portland, Homeless Town Hall. I know somebody who could be described as a Cascadia patient in that he's neurologically different from the rest of the population. And he was put in an SRO, and I don't know if the SRO is different from the shelters or the subsidized housing, but he left both due to the conditions of the unit and because of the noise factor, probably thin walls and cheap housing. He could hear the neighbors. And when you're neurologically different, being in a noisy atmosphere isn't good. When you're neurologically different, being exposed to toxins is much more impactful on somebody who's disabled than somebody who's healthy and can do something. And he left, and he's currently homeless and has been on the streets, I think, now for the last 4 or 5 years. He just left the unit. And so we have people who are disabled who are leaving units that are awful. And they're sleeping, they're choosing to sleep out on the streets rather than sleep in units that are so awful. Now, are these SROs and shelters subject to the same conditions? And as I would like to make one recommendation regarding moisture control and heat. When you're a low-income tenant, you can't afford electricity. So just give people free electricity for the coldest 6 months out of the year. And that's pretty easy. All you got to do, put a solar panel up on the roof. Free electricity. Okay, so the last thing I have to say is about the noise complaint from the Columbia neighborhood. In the Salvation Army,
this
is totally on point. We're talking about industrial noise here. We're talking about livability.
We're talking about a rental inspections program.
We have a busy agenda today, but thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Super Connectomics. One of the concerns I have on this is on the complaint-driven. Is that I do not want that to remain confidential. I think that should be open to the public. Now, as far as on retaliation, any judge is going to look at that. If you're filing your complaints and then they retaliate, that's a pretty clear-cut case normally. Now, issue number two is that if you do the inspection and you find over five items that are wrong, I don't think it should open up the whole building to be inspected. I think that should be on a case-by-case analysis per tenant, because in my experience is that when you own a building and you have maintenance slips that people can fill out, present that to either the manager, they tend to get things done. Now, let's just say that some people don't. What you run into is when you bring in the city of Portland is the cost is going to go up tremendously. That's number one you have to look at from the owner's position and the manager's position, because now you have a kind of a third party in the middle of this telling you what you need to do, when it needs to be done, and we'll come back and reinspect it. And if you don't, we're going to hit you for fines. So what you end up doing is escalating the cost tremendously, whereas opposed if the manager, direct communication to the manager in a reasonable manner and say, just assist me on this, see what you can do. And if they're trying to help you, the last thing you want to do is call BDS, because all they're coming in to do is cost recovery, fines, how much money they can make, and how they can support the people they're sending out to the properties. And what normally happens past that point, it can be passed on to rent increases. It can be passed on to just keeping the unit empty. It's just too much problem anymore. So that we need to be very cautious on that. And again, I didn't see anything on fire extinguishers being mandatory in the units. I would like to see that mandatory and inspected, because plain and simple, a small kitchen fire can be put out immediately if the extinguisher is close and ready to grab. But that small kitchen fire can end up burning half the building up if it's not there. And it's a very fast response to make sure it's put out immediately. And that's what needs to really be done from a safety issue in these apartments. And just again, from my position, tenants need to work with their managers in a responsible, respectful manner. There doesn't have to be confidentiality. And let the manager and the landlord understand your next move may be to go to BDS, which will increase your cost tremendously. So why don't we work together, live here peacefully, and enjoy where we're living. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like the rest of my time back to address a lot.
No, ma'am. Come on.
No, thank you very much, though. You made good points today. Okay, here, 20 seconds, please. Go ahead and make your point.
Well, one thing we have in a lot of these older units is, you know, older wiring and space. And what happens is it starts to rain, and somebody's got their appliance plugged in and on. Could be a radio, could be a refrigerator, could be an oven. I've seen all three cause electrical fires. And so they need to go in and check these electrical wiring.
Good point. Okay. Yeah, good point. Thank you. And was there one other individual?
Yeah, Jim Wittenberg signed up, and we've had a request from one person to speak who didn't get to sign up.
Fine. Come on up.
Okay. Margo. Speak.
Jim, you're back.
I know, and I'm on my way to a football game in Corvallis.
Huh?
It's the only chance we have to win one this year, I think. We might beat Stanford and then get a conference win for change. It hasn't happened for a long time.
Margo, would you like to go ahead?
Yes. Oh, sure. I can start. Good morning, commissioners and mayor. My name is Margo Black. I'm the co-chair of Portland Tenants United, which is a registered lobby organization with the City of Portland. I just wanted to offer a couple comments in response to some of the other questions and things that have come up. One, the reality of retaliation has, as Commissioner Udaly pointed out, changed quite a bit under or after relocation, and then even more under Senate Bill 608, which makes it much harder to terminate a tenancy. However, and I guess a couple items of clarification there. One, retaliation is illegal at the state level. However, there's a but-for standard. So, Lightning said it's a pretty straightforward case. It's really not, actually. The tenant has to show that the landlord's behavior wouldn't have occurred but for the report for the inspection. And most attorneys will agree that that is a very, very hard case to make and bring forward to court. Also, in terms of the confidentiality of reporting, often, unless a unit does make it to the enhanced inspection level, that complaint is tied to the unit, to the address. So even if the complainant information was, you know, kept confidential, landlord knows who lives there and who called in the complaint. And that puts folks in single-family homes and plexes at even higher risk, because it's much harder to see those get enhanced. And so I do hope that we move toward the mandatory inspection model, and I would think that we should prioritize the single families and small plexes, because those are the ones that are the hardest to call in on. Related to that, I want to share a story about a tenant, a Section 8 elderly black tenant in the Coley neighborhood who called Bureau of Development Services housing inspectors who were wonderful. Her landlord did retaliate very intensely and even very explicitly. He told me on the phone and even the inspectors that this is what she gets for calling the cops on him, and of, by cops, I mean the housing inspectors, who came in to see that he had an unpermitted bonus room and a couple of other violations that they required that he fix. He didn't terminate her tenancy because he couldn't. We negotiated her exit out of there with Relo, because in exchange for not suing him for other things, but that negotiation happened as a result of him essentially bullying and harassing her after calling BDS. And like I said, he made that very explicit to me. He even said she should know she's not wanted here after calling the cops. He also told the BDS inspectors that. And I think that in that case, BDS should be obligated in some way to A, inform the landlord of their obligations to not retaliate, inform the tenant of their rights to not be retaliated against. And in situations like that, there should be someone that BDS can report that to. And right now, it's no one's job. There's a landlord can basically tell an inspector all the ways they're breaking landlord-tenant law, and the inspector can't. There's nowhere to give that information. There's nothing to do with that. And I think that is a problem. We have a lot of folks in agencies representing really vulnerable people who see a lot of violations of landlord-tenant law outside of building code and can't do anything about it.
Thank you. Thank you. And Jim, I am in receipt of your petition here. It's not directly related to what we're discussing, so please keep your testimony related. Thank you.
The only reason I'm down here is because I'm on my way to Corvallis because there's a football game this weekend. We might be able to beat Stanford for the first time in many, many years and win a conference game. Secondly, I've turned 80 this year. I'm 80 years old, and this has not been a good year. I've been in the hospital now 16 times since January with a massive heart attack and had pneumonia and almost died. What are the things that I list on the each hospital form with the allergies? And the allergies are lisinopril, which is for a cough, if you get a cough, but it's also for yeast and for mold. Those are the three things I have trouble with. So the last two apartments I've had on Northeast Portland, one was I used during a campaign I was working in. I couldn't stay there because it had mold in it. The second one had mold in it, and they were selling drugs in the apartment building that was out on Russell and Williams Avenue. The problem with mold is that you can't get your breath and can't get your air into it. And it's hard to prove to most people that it's as dangerous as it is. Dr. Richard Baer, in 2004, I think I was running against you, Nick, I can't remember. But just as a lark.
Those are the good days.
Yeah, those are the great days. But he helped supported me and gave me some money, I think $100 or something. He's a great guy. But he worked on lead, and his big as a doctor was to work on the lead in apartments because it was killing and making brain dead the little kids that were coming up. So it's these are very, very important issues, or I wouldn't have wasted your time here. The last thing, I put an initiative on the ballot in 1978, and I said that we should only pay a percent and a half for 1,000 property tax in Oregon, and we got 209,000 signatures, which is still a record, I believe, in Oregon, and we didn't pay any signatures. We paid no money to anybody. So I'm experienced in doing that. It's 40 years ago, 41 years ago. The reason I have this up here now is I made a mistake then. It should have been anybody over 60 shouldn't be paying property taxes. That would include my dad, who's now dead, never got to, and my brother, who's dead, and many friends who are dead also, because they need that money, many of them, to take care of their houses, which they've paid for 40, 50 years. And now they're starting to fall apart. My lady friend's house up here on on the last thing. She contracted mold in her house and didn't have the money to take care of it. And that's right there by where Darcel lives, if you know the area. And she has a beautiful house, but it's not mold infested. And I'm trying to help her the best I can, but it's a very, very expensive. Anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate your
time. Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Please root for Oregon State. This is the one chance they have this year, I think, to win a game.
We'll take that one to the bank, Jim. Thanks for being here. I just want to make a quick acknowledgement. Virginio Merola is here. He is the mayor of Bologna, Italy. Thank you for being here and honoring us with your presence. And we also have the Consul General of Italy, based out of San Francisco, Lorenzo Ortona. Thank you, sir, for being here. We appreciate it. And I know some of us had an opportunity to meet with you yesterday, and we feel very privileged to have you here and celebrating not only our sister city relationship, but some great events that are taking place at the Art Museum and other cultural issues. And we thank you again for honoring us.
Mayor, I've waited over 20 years to say this, or actually 31 years. I want to thank our friends from Italy. My wife and I spent our honeymoon in Italy. And we started in Rome, went to Portofino, Florence, Venice, and Milan. So we somehow missed Bologna, which was a grievous oversight. But we ate our way through Italy and had a wonderful time. And the people of Italy were so warm and generous. And this relationship that we have with Bologna is very special, and as are many of our sister city relationships. But this one runs deep. So we're honored to have the mayor and the delegation with us today.
Mayor. Thank you. Commissioner Daly.
Welcome, everyone. And I just want to take this opportunity to acknowledge that this is the 15th anniversary of our sister city relationship with Bologna, and invite the public to the Portland Art Museum this evening at 5 o'clock for an incredible exhibit of Italian children's book illustrators. This is their gift to our city for this special occasion of the anniversary, and I cannot wait to see it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Could we get staff back up just to maybe react to some of the testimony? In particular, one of the questions was asked about creating maybe an anonymous web portal that... there was a suggestion to maybe have an anonymous web portal with a tracking number. That struck me as a very common sense approach. Can you tell me what we already have in place and maybe what the thinking is about that?
We have an online portal where folks can submit a complaint through our web page. It creates a track it number, so we can track it with a number. They do have to provide their name and phone number and contact information, because we need to contact them to gain entry. But we actually encrypt that information when we start the file. So our files are public records, our inspection results are public records, but the actual complainant information and their phone number is, we don't share.
Mayor,
I
have a hard time thinking about an exemption that would apply here. And I think Margot Black also said something that, a very common sense thing, which is, once the complaint is made, a landlord has a pretty good idea who made it, particularly in the single family residence area. So I think I'm not sure our focus should be on confidentiality, because I don't know that we'd win that fight. I think our focus should be on more robust anti-retaliation provisions, because that's if you know, most civil rights cases, people I don't think realize, are decided not so much on the affirmative case of discrimination, but on the retaliation side for having complained about it, because it's a much easier case. So I think that's where we might want to have staff look at ways we could beef that up. But I think we're going to go down the wrong path if we think about confidentiality. I don't think it's practically possible. And B, I'd be very surprised if there's an exemption that we could craft.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Commissioner Fish. Thinking out loud, to me, it just seems that if you have a complaint in a multifamily unit apartment complex, that you would want to inspect all the apartments in that complex. So therefore, you would not, in fact, be singling out one individual property, but you would say that that would trigger that you needed to do some minimum level of inspection of all the apartments in that complex. Otherwise, why would you like take one complaint and then come back next year when you get another complaint and then do the same, go through the whole process again?
I totally agree with you, and that's the beauty of the ERIP program. It allows us that opportunity to inspect all those units. And that's kind of the impetus behind that program.
But it just what triggers that? What's the threshold? Because
it's a complaint. It's based on how many violations that we find. We have to have more than two violations in at least two of five categories, which on most inspections is not hard to meet. We will typically find enough violations to trigger an ERIP if it's a rental property.
Please don't use ERIP. That just sounds like somebody's about to rip out
our enhanced rental inspections program.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any further discussion on this item? Thank you for a great presentation. Yeah, Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Fish?
Oh, do we have a
new? I'm sorry. You daily?
Yeah, I thought we did.
I thought you called for the roll.
We're voting. It's an emergency.
It's an emergency.
Oh, I see. I thought it was just the first reading.
It's the implement the recommendations.
All right. I guess I'm an aye. Yes, I'll be voting.
All right. Are we back on track, Carla?
Sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I know where I am now. Thank you.
You said, okay, let's start over. Hard to see. Okay. You daily.
Okay. I was excited that I might be towards the end again, but I'm still in second. I want to thank the Bureau and thank the mayor for continuing on this work. This is one of a handful of items that my office was really hoping to advance while we had BDS. So I'm very pleased that this is happening. I want to just highlight the connection between housing quality and health and equity in this city. We know that we have a preponderance of low-income renters who are living in unsafe substandard housing, and that is impacting their health, the health of their families, and their very futures. And it's completely unacceptable that landlords are allowed to continue to rent these substandard units. And I have explored the possibility of preventing rent increases on substandard units. It didn't seem achievable, but I just want to go on record to saying I think it's absolutely outrageous that property owners are allowed to increase rents when they are offering substandard housing. I believe that we need to have stiffer penalties for ongoing violations, up to and including eminent domain, taking the properties away if they continue to endanger tenants. And finally, Diana, I believe, brought up a really great point, which is not only do, Mayor, there's disruption going on in the chambers.
Okay, listen, everybody heard you. Now please listen to the commissioner. Sorry, Commissioner.
I'm not sure what the conflict of interest is. I am not a property owner or a landlord. I am someone that cares about the health and safety and basic human rights of people in the city. And finally, Diana mentioned a concern about not only do tenants have to fear retaliation, they have to fear displacement and becoming homeless. And so I believe these landlords should be 100% responsible for the cost of rehousing tenants in the event that their units are unlivable. And some of them are just absolutely not fit for human habitation. I vote aye. Oh, wait. I want to thank Carrie Lyons who so passionately pursued my staff to see this through. She once told my director of policy that if Title 29 code change ever happened, she would be happy for the rest of her life. So, Carrie, you're welcome. And
nice.
I expect to see you smiling for eternity. Yes. I vote aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Well, first of all, I just want to say nobody should find this in any way onerous. What we're talking about here is regulations to prevent mold, which is damaging to public health, pests, which is also damaging to public health, lead paint, and things that are common sense as far as I'm concerned. I want to thank Commissioner Udaly. I know that this is an issue that you put front and center when BDS was in your portfolio, so I want to thank you and your team. I want to thank the folks from the Housing Bureau, the City Risk Office, the Multnomah County Health Department, and they worked with us on some of the public health aspects of this ordinance, as well as the Rental Service Commission and Housing Oregon's Property Management Asset Working Group. So this is truly a community group effort. This was also undertaken by many of the bureaus here in the city of Portland. It's all, I believe, for the better, and I want to thank everybody who helped. I also want to thank everybody who testified today. I thought this was a very good dialogue, and I appreciated it, and I am happy to vote aye. The ordinance is adopted.